It's been almost 3 years since 49 people were killed by a gunman at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. The shooter swore allegiance to ISIS, but he targeted a gay bar, making it the deadliest incident of violence against LGBT people in American history. Before that, the title belonged to the Upstairs Lounge in New Orleans, where 32 people were killed in 1973. Back then, because so many gay Americans were in the closet, many families of victims didn't want to come forward to say their loved ones had been inside. Robert Fiesler tells the story of the fire in his book Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. He joins me now. Robert, welcome.
Happy to be here, Jeremy.
So until the Pulse nightclub shooting, this was the worst attack on the gay community in American history. 1973, a gay bar in New Orleans called the Upstairs Lounge. Tell us what happened.
So on the night of June 24th, 1973, a group of about 100 working-class gay men were gathered at a secret second-story bar located on the ragtag fringe of New Orleans' famous French Quarter. And they were gathered for what was then the biggest party of the week at this bar called the Beer Bust. This was New Orleans in the 70s. So the Beer Bust drink special was $1 for 2 hours of unlimited draft beer. Okay, this is for people who are having quite a bit of fun. In the midst of the Beer Bust, a lot of these gay men who lived secretive, closeted lives, but who were open and out inside this haven, inside this secret second-story bar. In the midst of this this crazy conviviality, a man picked a fight, and that gentleman was ejected from the bar. And as he was ejected violently, drunkenly, he screamed, quote, "I'm going to burn you all out." Mm-hmm. And about 30 minutes later, a spark was lit in the downstairs staircase that had served as the lone entrance and exit to this quite popular French Quarter borderline gay bar. And that led to a terrible cataclysmic tragedy. Essentially, everything inside the bar turns out was flammable. And within a span of less than 20 minutes, 29 people were dead. And about three others were doomed to agonizing deaths in a hospital burn ward. So as you mentioned, it was the deadliest event to strike the LGBT plus community of America for about 43 years until the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, a record that never should have been broken.
But the difference, one of the differences between what happened in New Orleans and the Pulse nightclub shooting is after it happened, many of the victims' families didn't even want to claim that their loved ones were in there because it was so taboo to not just be gay, but to be connected to somebody who was.
Correct. It was a very different time period. So in 1973, when you look at values opinions polls, 70% of Americans believed homosexuality to be always wrong. And when they were polled as well about First Amendment rights for homosexuals, about whether or not a gay person should be allowed to speak in public, one third of Americans disagreed with that. So the gay community, in so much as the word gay was even used in the 70s, was so sidelined and marginalized that the reaction to this fire was not one of sympathy. It was one of embarrassment and humiliation.
Well, and in fact, one of the things that you write in this book is that some of the people who survived didn't want to tell people how they were injured.
Absolutely, because they would face consequences in their own lives, a range of personal and professional consequences. There were no laws protecting gays in the workplace at that time period. Most gay people in New Orleans lived very careful existences where their bosses and coworkers did not know where they went to on the weekends and at nights in the course of their private lives. So there was a real possibility for some of these survivors that if people found out at their workplaces that they had been in the bar that burned the night before, they would lose their jobs. And thus, a lot of men had to go to work the next day, that Monday, and act like they didn't know what happened.
Why did you want to tell the story of what happened at the Upstairs Lounge so many decades later?
Well, this was a pivotal event at the crossroads of early gay liberation, the early LGBT rights movement that's like smack in the middle between the Stonewall riots, which kicked a lot off politically in 1969, and then the anti-Anita O'Brien orange juice boycotts in 1977, which is a little bit prior to the assassination of Harvey Milk the following year. So it's this vital forgotten, buried event that's what journalists might call a blue whale. It's this event that sounded and sank in the past, dwelled unspoken for years and decades, and then it resurfaced in our present time, specifically in the wake of the Pulse nightclub shooting, when people were looking for context, grasping for anything to try to understand that terrible field of slaughter in Orlando. The upstairs lounge fire resurfaced in that span of time, and it sings this really strange song of a very different past, a shocking one that's about what life was like for gay men at a certain place in a certain time.
How difficult was it for you to research what happened? Because even the news articles that came out right after the upstairs lounge fire didn't give a lot of information about exactly what was going on. They were being careful about saying that this was a gay bar, et cetera.
Sure, it was difficult. One of the more difficult things actually was not from a news perspective, actually. For about 2 days following the fire, the upstairs lounge fire was the prototypical hot, amazing true crime story. And you can find examples of coverage in newspapers in London, newspapers in Paris, newspapers in Australia. So this was international news. It wasn't until people learned the nature of the bar that had burned and the character of the individuals who had died inside the bar that this was a gay bar that had served gay clientele, that all news coverage disappeared and dissipated. Because in large part at that time period, a general public readership was not going to be able to muster sympathy for those kind of victims. And newspapers and media outlets understood that.
Including the New York Times.
Absolutely, absolutely. Which a famous reporter actually did the original upstairs lounge coverage in the New York Times, a gentleman named Roy Reed, who was a famous Southern civil rights reporter. But Roy Reed, I actually was able to get one of the final interviews that he ever gave prior to his death a few years ago, actually, where he spoke about, he said that his coverage of the upstairs lounge fire was the first instance where the New York Times had actually assigned him a story to cover the gay community, and he thinks they did it by mistake. He thought they did it at that time period because they were interested in a true crime story, another deadly event to strike downtown New Orleans, rather than the homosexual angle, which he did actually end up pursuing.
What do you think that this story says about where we are today as a nation? Obviously, it's a very different time for LGBTQ Americans.
I think this event speaks to today, especially when you're looking at this summer. It's the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. So that's causing a half-century look back at the LGBT plus rights movement. And what the upstairs lounge fire does is it shows us that we shouldn't just celebrate our triumphal march to civil liberties, actually, but it's important to recall and remember the lost history of atrocities, such as the upstairs lounge fire, such as the AIDS epidemic, such as countless other examples of violence and individuals of the queer community who fell in the intervening years, because our acts of memory are viable acts of protest now.
By the way, you mentioned the AIDS epidemic. Some of the victims of the upstairs lounge fire ended up dying of AIDS a decade later.
They perished in the intervening years, tragically. Could you imagine surviving such a terrible, traumatic event in your youth and then dying in the epidemic slowly?
Well, and agonizing. One that you're keeping quiet after the upstairs lounge fire. You don't want to talk about it with everybody and then having to deal with the same thing with AIDS.
With AIDS hysteria and the stigma that followed, yes.
You actually live in New Orleans now.
I do.
Have you been to the area where the upstairs lounge was?
I pass by it every day, and I pass by the monument that was laid down at the 30th anniversary of the tragedy by an individual. He was a gay pastor who fought a very lonely battle in the late 90s and early 2000s in New Orleans to set down this 32-inch by 32-inch bronze plaque that's before the historic door of the upstairs lounge. And every day I read the names of the victims. And it's not just me. I notice oftentimes when I pass on my way to the library where I write in the French Quarter now, I see a lot of strangers and I see a lot of tourists pausing and pondering and wondering. And it's actually a very moving thing to see, because you can see how that monument is advertising the event and has caused and raised awareness. In a sense, one could argue that it's helped give birth to all of the scholarship on the upstairs lounge fire that's actually come out into the public domain in the past few years. I mean, this event that was considered obscure, unknown, to a certain extent, it was considered irrelevant to LGBT canon, is now on the map. and I think a real reason why it's on the map is because it was considered worthy of a monument.
And yet, I just spoke recently with the family members of one of the victims of the upstairs lounge, Ferris LeBlanc, whose body was put into an unmarked grave. They're still trying to get his remains.
They are. They are still fighting Louisiana bureaucracy for the ability to exhume their beloved family member, Ferris LeBlanc, who served honorably in World War II and is worthy of military burial rights in a family plot. And he still lays in this out-of-the-way, decrepit field where the family has been trying for several years now to get to him, unable to do so. Strangely enough, and we still see this again, the upstairs lounge fire was swept under the rug so brutally in the 70s that to this day, those who are trying to raise awareness, honor the victims, are still facing a struggle. The upstairs lounge fire is still, in a sense, contemporary news.
That's Robert Fiesler. His book is called Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. It's out in paperback this summer. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.